Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, September 6th, 2007. And I just want to open this by saying two things. One, an optimistic, and one, a pessimistic statement. First of all, I think there are a lot of people out there who can really fare quite well, even in a disaster scenario. But unfortunately, I don't think that the disasters would be as bad as they might end up being if we had true planning, true management, and true foresight coming out of the leaders of our countries. If the very simple thing about preparation, as I've said many times before, is that preparation is the same no matter what the disaster, whether it's a natural disaster, whether it's man-made, or anything combination in between. Preparation is the same. Once you're prepared, you don't have to prepare every day. It's a one-time investment, so to speak. And so the fact that our leaders are off willy-nilly doing everything else under the sun except getting the public prepared. And now if you look at the public preparations, there simply are none. If you think a government truck is going to come up the street after a disaster, you're simply wrong. It's not going to happen, especially in a major nationwide disaster. Typically, they can handle small pocket areas, and it gives people the false impression that somehow the government has the ability to manage and take care of you in a real disaster, a real large-scale disaster. But I've come to the conclusion, after many years of thought on this, I really think we need two totally distinct governments in the United States. The one government is the one that's there now, because you're not going to rout them out, you're not going to get rid of them. They are invested. You have the Bush Clinton White House. You got the Lady Bush or Lady Clinton coming up on the, I shouldn't call her a lady, maybe the female Clinton coming up on the White House, and it's already been designated that she will be your next president. So at any rate, not to get into politics, but the second one, the second government should be for people who want to develop this earth into a nice place. Because we can't coexist in the same government entity as those people over there that want to destroy everything, keep everything down. So anybody that wants to be in that government to pay unrealistically high taxes to support a war that will never end, and then they should also be the people that send their kids to that war. And that whole government should be one entity. And then people will belong to that political party, and they'll literally live in this country, possibly next door to people who don't contribute anything to that at all. And then there is the second group. Now, this is the second government entity in the United States, and those are the people that want to simply live a decent life, put their resources into a better life here, and helping other people and making sure that everybody has a meal every day and developing true education, not this out of a rubber stamp education system that we have today. I just see it as pathetic the way kids are treated and the lack of creativity. The first thing, of course, that gets cut in education are the art and sports and things like that that really develop the character of kids. If you look at the Greek education of the ancient Greeks, they developed the total person. By the time you got done with your education, You didn't just sit there and learn and sit in the classroom and listen. You discussed. You had conversations with your teacher, etc. And I don't see that happening, unfortunately. And we're paying a very big price for very poor education across the board. And kids, let me tell you, I've been in education myself my whole life, literally. Even when I worked in industry, I still had my ties to education. Kids are interested. Kids have a lot of energy, and if you give them something to be interested in, and you find what they want to learn about, those kids, you can't draw them away with 100 horses, because they're going to go there, and they're interested, and they're going to do it. What I see today, though, is kids don't have anything to do. So they find their own directions, and a lot of times it's not a good direction. So, unfortunately, the education system is failing our youth because it's not putting in front of them the opportunities. How many schools are there where you could just have a classroom with instruments in there and the kids would be able to go in and jam and play a guitar? Each kid has to have his own guitar, his own instrument or whatever it is. There's no place you can just go, some poor kid. Can't go someplace and pick up a decent instrument or a piano and sit down and play it out of interest because his parents can't afford it. They can't afford to have all these instruments in the house. So these kids sit there and some of them luck out and get a guitar or an instrument, and a lot of them, the majority, do not. So at any rate, I'm not going to get off on that, but this is where the second government would come in and be a totally separate autonomous entity, and you would belong to that government even though you lived in the same country. This idea that a single government will serve all the people in a country is not true anymore, because when that government is taken over by a special interest group, then all bets are off. Because everybody has to do what they want to do, and that's what's going on right now. There's no second ballpark. It's the government team or no team. Here's the point also, that as I watch political candidates jockeying for position in the upcoming election, if you call it an election, they are talking about their issues, and typically they are issues created by government, the war, the recession. All of the issues these people are talking about are literally created by the government. So it's this dog and pony show. Now, I want to bring up one last point. If we had an economic system, as the founding fathers had intended, with value money and no taxation of individuals, there would never be a recession. The recession is a contrived situation where people lose what they have. And this is done through manipulation of money, through the stock market, and through other financial means, so that the public is literally sapped of their resources about every 10 years. This would not happen if your government was doing what it was originally intended to do. There would never be a recession because corporations would have value money as their basis. Individuals would own their houses. You would not be paying this vast amount of interest to a foreign bank through the Federal Reserve, which borrows money so it can loan it to you, and it's all phony money. There is no real value there. All the gold has been taken and absconded by the Queen of England, by the Rothschilds. These people are sitting on the gold, and that's what makes them, that's what gives them their value, so to speak. But the money they give you is worthless. It isn't worth the paper it is printed on, or the number in the ledger. The ink on that number is not worth anything because there's really no money there. Phony wars, phony money, phony taxation, and ownership of resources. Now, this gets down to the scientific aspect of economics. who owns the resources? And in today's world, we have somehow allowed the government to position certain people to gain resources. And of course, this started in the 1800s. As soon as this country was formed, the explorers went out and came back with stories of vast resources. And ever since, it's been a race for the people standing at the door of the government, the special interest groups, to gain control of those resources, whether it was timber or iron or metals, whether it was oil. When the oil started to come into use in this country, energy, nuclear energy, coal, huge industries with special interest. And the point is that the United States has been carved up, the game of Monopoly is over, and the general public is the loser in this vast game of Monopoly. So what does this have to do with science? Actually, quite a bit, because as I was talking with a friend of mine this morning, 99% of all scientists and their work belong to the government. A lot of people think, well, I work for a private industry, but you look at what they're developing, what they're building, and that undoubtedly will end up somewhere in another corporation that is getting their money directly from the government. So science as a resource is owned by the government. It's a very scary item to consider for most people, that all of our science and engineering is literally owned by the government. And what happens to that is even more scary. A lot of it being used against the public. Now, to the biggest enemy of the government is the free-thinking public. Okay, so that's enough of that, but as I said, what we need in this country now is simply a completely second autonomous government. And the only way you can do that now is simply by doing what they call dropping out, or living in their economy but not contributing to it, if that's possible. But even at that, a lot of people are going under. Now, the one last point that and the reason I'm bringing it up on this show is because I do not hear economists, people with radio shows that should be covering these topics, I don't hear them talking about these specific topics. And the last one is that the very wealthy people now are starting to fold in the United States. That tells you that we're on the very last fringes of the plan to take down the United States. Because those people were necessary. They were in the news media, they were attorneys, they were doctors, they were people with vast investments in the stock market. These were people who sent their kids to the best schools. And all of a sudden, these people are going under financially. That is the last signal that this country is on the verge of going down completely. And that's, I've talked about that before, because they would need those people. The plan was to take out the lower economic sector first, then part of the middle class, and then bring the middle class down. That has already been accomplished. And then you go into the first tier of what we might call wealthy people, people that might have $1 million in equity in a house possibly, but not a lot of cash. Not $1 million in liquid cash. Those people have already gone under. Now we're talking about the people with 50, 100, 200, $500 million invested. Of course, you can't have that money in your wallet, so it's invested. Those people are going under now. And they're starting to look around and going, oh, how come I went under? Everybody else was supposed to go under, not me. But those people are starting to go under. So the very top 2% of American wealthy people are starting to drop through the cracks. And when they scream, nobody's listening, are they? Anyway, that's the end of Economics 101. On to science topics. This week we had Hurricane Felix, Category 5 hurricane, heading into Nicaragua. And, of course, I'm sure doing a great deal of damage there. Indigenous Indians, natives that live on some of the outlying islands, unable to evacuate. And so we are not sure of the end result there, but probably being very hard hit with really nothing to save them from this awful storm. Flooding, etc. I did get... I found it interesting or almost comical to see the National Hurricane Center, as they talked about Hurricane Felix, saying that the mountains of Nicaragua took the energy out of Hurricane Felix. That's almost as funny as the mountains of Yucatan taking the punch out of Hurricane Wilma just a short year or two ago. The mountains and the land do not break down a hurricane. It's the electrical connection to land that drains the hurricane of its energy. Once again, the National Hurricane Prediction Center having no clue what causes a hurricane or what drains the energy from a hurricane. At any rate, we are right now in the edge, the turbulent edge of what I call the August return current sheet. That's a region of the solar system Earth passes through in the month of August, and it's an electrical current sheet that literally connects from the outer region of the solar system, and it's a very wide area where this current flows back to the sun as in the region where Earth passes through in the month of August. That's why we have the peak hurricane season. That's why we have the peak aurora borealis, or northern light season in August. That's why we have the peak tornado season in August, etc. That's why the peak tropical hurricane season in the Pacific peaks around August. So at any rate, the reason is we have all of this extra energy flowing by us in outer space. And as I said before on a week or two ago radio show, that the hurricanes we saw in that August 9th to 18th region, a lot of that was literally powered from the return current sheet because the sun was very quiet at that time. So our energy actually was flowing in to our weather systems from outer space from the August return current sheet. And if people are not quite familiar with this, I'll just give a short explanation, and that'll somewhat lead into the main science topic for the night. I'm going to be talking about how the inner core and the outer core and the atmosphere of the sun actually work, and also talk about some of the misnomers, some of the misinformation, some of the archaic theories of standard science that simply do not work, but they hold on to them. But at any rate, here's just a little brief explanation of the August return current sheet. And this is not from standard science, mind you. This is from my own science that I developed back in the late 1970s, and it was one of the mysteries I had to solve to understand what drove the electrical conditions in the solar system. And you find that modern science today has no clue about any of this. And let's put it this way, the Tier 2 science of today, the science that you see coming out of NASA or the National Weather Service or the National Hurricane Prediction Center, none of these scientific entities have any clue or include any of this in their scientific modeling or in their knowledge base. And there's a reason for that. Because if you understood where this energy came from to drive hurricanes, to drive tornadoes, to drive thunderstorms, it would be a short trip to understand that we can tap into this energy and we would no longer need the nuclear energy or coal or other forms of energy that give us electricity. We would not need oil because we would be a natural electrical energy-based society, and it would be free. Now, just one other additional note, there are many people running around talking about free energy, and there's a lot of hoaxes out there. But the free energy that I'm talking about has already been proven to be there. A guy named Tesla was able to tap into this. And in fact, every time Tesla's name comes up now, they try and purport that he was transmitting energy with his Tesla towers, which is ridiculous. Where did he supposedly get the energy to transmit? What magical source did this come from? Well, the real story is that he was tapping into the external electric sources that I've been talking about, one of them being powered by the August return current sheet, which drives the hurricanes and the other storms. The bottom line is, we could be running on a free electrical-based society around the world, and it would actually diminish the storms. We would be able to have rain where we need it and eliminate rain where we're having flooding. All of this could be done with sound management, but as I said before, all our political candidates are running around jumping up and down over man-made created problems, none of them solving the true problems of man. Just think, for example, with the flooding we had, say, in southern Minnesota this past month. In August, we had incredible flooding. All that water just flowed right down the Mississippi River, and by now it's out in the Gulf of Mexico. We have need for fresh water in this country, and we do have adequate rainfall. But we're letting it all just roll off the top and roll down the rivers and into the ocean. And if with an adequate duct system, with reservoirs strategically placed around this country, we could trap that floodwater, move it off to where it's needed, and we would not have a water problem. We could have a greening of the southwest United States like you never imagined. But we have a water management problem. The other problem is with everything else. Now, greedy businesses are getting in the path of water and water ownership. So you're going to see the fruition of this coming in the next 10 years. And the people are simply going to be at the beck and call of government, because you see the foreclosures. This is not by accident. This is designed to take this country down economically. It's the end of a plan, and there's no safety net to catch this country. There's no industry. There's nothing to save the United States of America. It is going under. I'm amazed it's still there at this point. And at any point in time, it could very well go under. In fact, the daily prognosis for this country is, actually, there are a lot of people who consider that right now the United States is bankrupt. It's just printing phony money. There's phony money being inserted into the stock market, and there's really no value there at all. Back to the August return current sheet, which is one of the sources of free electrical energy that we could tap into as a human race if it were not for your friendly federal government and their worldwide consortium of governments who have given energy an industry and a monopoly. Here's what happens. The sun gives off its surface what they call the solar wind. The solar wind was discovered a couple of decades ago. I'll be talking more about that in the science topic later in the show. But it's literally a wind of charged particles coming off the surface of the sun. Scientists assume, and they make an assumption incorrectly, that there is an equal current of electrons and protons and charged particles. In other words, there's no net electrical charge coming off the sun. And what I discovered in my researches, like I said, in the late 1970s, is that assumption was wrong. And I could see the effects of this charging all over the solar system. I could see it in the data that was coming back from spacecraft. Here's what happens. There is actually an excess current of protons that goes out in the solar wind, and it blows out past Earth, past all the planets, and out to about a couple times the distance to Pluto, the very farthest planet. It blows out in all directions from the sun, and it forms a capacitor. It's an electrical battery where you have more positive charge out there, and it leaves the sun with somewhat of a negative balance charge. And this process cannot go on forever. Some of that charge has to cycle back to the sun to keep this electrical current going. But the point is that when the question is, where exactly does that electrical current come back to the sun? And what I've discovered is it comes back to the sun in the region of the solar system where Earth passes through in the month of August. Now, there may be other return current sheets coming back to the sun, but this is one that we noticeably see every year on our path through the sun, or around the sun. The point is that this is a very broad electrical current. It's not like a wire or a thin composite electrical current that you would have going through a wire. It covers a very broad region of outer space. And it's somewhat like a tube, but it snakes around out there. So it whips around, and off the edges of this, there's a good deal of turbulence because the solar wind is trying to come out the other direction. So you have to, it's kind of like a river flowing through another river. The river of solar wind particles coming out from the sun is moving outwards, and this return current sheet is making its way back to the sun along this very wide, big area of outer space that we pass through in the month of August. Sometimes it can extend into September, even October. Sometimes we pass out of it, then it whips back and we're passing through it again. And it's during these turbulent times of change in that August return current sheet that we get severe weather. Now, when I made my predictions for August 9th through 18th for that severe weather time, earthquakes, volcanic activity, there were many other factors, including a new moon passing, and Venus being in inferior conjunction. So that allowed me to put all those factors together to understand that August 9th through 18th would be a very volatile time for those natural disasters on Earth. And in fact, I hit it right on the nose. Those predictions I made in May or even earlier. Actually, I think I was on a show in February where I was talking about that time frame. People asked me when I was a guest on a radio show, what is my prediction for the year? And I said, well, that August, centered around August 12th period, is going to be very influential. And then when I started refining my dates, I went from August 9th to the 18th and hit it right on the nose. And part of the effects of that time frame were the fact that we would be right in the heart, right in the middle of that August return current sheet during that time. So, at any rate, we are now on the edge, or moving out into the edge of that, where we get a lot of turbulence. It's kind of like the turbulence that comes off the trailing edge of an airplane wing, only this is electrical currents passing through outer space. As I said, as the river of electrical charge comes back from the far reaches of the solar system, it's moving back towards the sun, while the solar wind is trying to move out away from the sun, and they interact and cause a bit of turbulence. That's what causes a lot of our kind of crazy, unpredictable weather as we move through into September and into October, when the hurricane season finally dies down. The hurricane season is typically build from about July to November. It could start as early as June, but typically they say July to the end of October is what is typically called our hurricane season. So at any rate, as I move into the science topic for tonight, solar heating at the surface of the sun is one of the great mysteries of modern science. and I'll be explaining how this works. Repeatedly over the last couple weeks, there have been articles surfacing in the public media, the newspapers, in the science medium on the internet, showing how new observations at the surface of the sun are occurring. And in fact, they are not explained by any of the standard theories. And then I'll talk about some of those standard theories and why they simply do not work. How do you get the energy supposedly from the core of the sun up to the surface and then have it interact in that manner? So anyway, I'll be talking about that. But just one more point. I'm personally quite worried, and I don't like to talk about politics, but this borders on politics, the mismanagement of resources. And it's really, we only have so many resources on this planet. We have already expended our timber resource. We have already expended our steel, our iron resource on the North Shore, where in the iron ranges of northern Minnesota, where the majority of iron came from to put us through World War II. The majority of iron on the world market today, the scrap steel and scrap iron market, the majority of that iron came from the pit mines in northern Minnesota, the Mesabi Range. And they've been mining out of there since the 1800s. It was the primary source of steel and metal during World War II. It's what fueled the auto industry after World War II, and it is now depleted. I'll say that a little louder. It is now depleted. The iron on the Great Iron Ranges are depleted. It's gone. They're digging out a little bit of what they call taconite, extremely low processed pellets of iron ore. But let's face it, everybody, the wood industry has cut every stick of tree down in this country. It's gone. The iron industry is gone. The resources are gone. Our offshore oil, a lot of the regions don't produce enough oil to support our oil habit. We have to import it. From about 20% of it comes from Venezuela. The president of Venezuela recently said, Hugo Chavez said, the United States uses too much oil. And he's right. We use far too much of that resource, and we're not going to use up the oil resource because there is a lot more than what they're talking about, but we cannot continue burning it. The point is that resource management simply does not exist. And this is why I started off getting down about politics, because politicians seem to think that there's no end to resources, all the way down to your local government, where the contractors, as the economics get worse and worse, more and more contractors are going to turn to local government for their nickel. And you're going to find your local government bending backwards to these people as they get their shoe into the door of local governments, municipalities, townships, counties, state governments are all going to be, they're going to have contractors lined up down the block and around the corner, all waiting for a piece of that government pie because it's the only game in town. But with the major resources, the next one to go is going to be water. There's no question about it. The corporations are already lining up at the political feeding trough to get their share of the cut of water, and you, the public, will once again be the loser, because who owns the resources? Doesn't matter who owns them. The question is who gets the political piece of the pie, who gets the legislation, and who gets the control. And the answer is the public doesn't. Under our current system of government, the corporations get it, the ones that get in there first, and believe me, they have already been there. They've already gotten their shoe in the door. The ownership of water, a lot of it will be simply absconded with, but the end result is the public is going to pay a premium for water starting very soon. This is why I sell the Berkey water filter. It's something that I don't care if you believe me or not. It's simply a reality. We're starting to see the lake level of Lake Superior is down 2 feet. The water situation is critical. And as I said, we do not have a water problem in this country. We have a water management problem. And once that is in the political works, you're not going to undo it. As I said before, the only problem with my two-government plan that I was talking about in the beginning is that the one government that is there is using all the resources and distributing all the resources to greedy people, to control and to sell back to you at an exorbitant price. So just once again, if you are not your own source of fresh water, then you're going to be in big trouble someday. Because the cities, as I've seen, and I've done more and more studies on this in the past couple years, and of course there's a lot of information regarding this on the internet. I'm not the only one talking about this. The ability of municipalities to provide you with clean water is going downhill very fast. You cannot trust what comes out of your tap. And so the other thing is, in an emergency, a lot of people say, well, I have an inline water filter system. As soon as there's an emergency, the first thing to be turned off will be your water, and the last thing to go back on will be your water. So your inline water filter system is worthless if you don't have the city putting water into your water system with pressure. They simply would not work. So at any rate, the long story, make it short. What I recommend, in fact, I tell people, if you don't have one of these water filters, you are literally crazy, because that's the one thing you're going to need. Just very briefly, if you want to check this out, my website is jmccsci.com, and the mail order address, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. I'll give that again in a minute here. But basically, $315, the price is set by the manufacturer. And so I have a couple incentives, but for $315, you get the big Berkey 2.25-gallon water filter. It's two metal containers. One sits on top of the other. There's no hoses, no electric connections. You just plug the two filters or the four filter elements into it, pour the water in, and it filters it. And very shortly, you can produce a lot of water, about 20 gallons per day, enough for a fairly good-sized group of people. It's portable. You can put it under your arm and carry it. It only weighs a couple pounds. And you have a portable fresh water system, whether you're on a trip. I know people that take these with them if they go to Mexico, or if they go to down south, or if they go to Florida. They will take their Berkey water filter with them so that they know they are drinking healthy water. It's very easy to travel with these things. You put the top unit in the bottom one, and you walk away, and you, no matter where you are, you have a source of clean, fresh water. People have them up at their cabin or their second home. Anyway, you get the big Berkey water filter, two stainless steel containers, plus two filter elements that you plug in that filter the water, plus two extra water filter elements that you will need in case of emergency. Then I offer the free Cato. This is a free shortwave emergency radio. It's an excellent radio. It's what I carry with me when I travel. It's the Cato WRX 911 shortwave radio that you can listen to this show on, and free shipping to the 50 states. That's all for $315. So once again, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, or the mail order address, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. On to the science topic for tonight. Now, I'm talking about the the conditions on the sun. And at the very end, what I'm going to explain is how this solar wind from the sun gets to Earth and affects our weather, earthquakes, volcanoes, etc. How does it affect the overall solar system? And one of the effects, I've already talked about the August return current sheet. It's something that the sun is doing all the time, and when we pass through that current sheet in August, it depends on what the sun was doing possibly 1 or 2 or 3 years ago. The extent of that current, that's how long it takes that electrical current to pass all the way out to the far edges of the solar system and then trickle back to us. It's a cycle. And so what we were experiencing here in August and even now depends on what the sun did possibly a long time ago, maybe years ago. So at any rate, let me start with a brief explanation of solar theory and solar discoveries. It was back in the Middle Ages, a guy named Newton was one of the first scientists to break apart the information we're getting from the sun. And here's what they did. Well, Newton had a prism, and he was able to break the light of the sun into its component colors. So they understood that the white light from the sun was really a mixture of colors, all blended together. But the other thing they did is they would take a mirror or a lens and concentrate the energy of the sun into a container, where they would trap all of the energy from the sun and watch the temperature rise. And then they knew the area of the lens, in other words, how much energy is coming through that region of space. And then they would multiply that by all the space surrounding the sun and make a calculation. And they knew how far away the sun was, so they could actually make a calculation of the surface temperature and the heat coming off the sun. And that heat was in the form of light. The only thing they knew about at that time was the light coming from the sun. They were totally unaware of anything electrical or solar wind or anything of that nature, particulate matter coming off the sun. They just thought it was this hot thing, this orange ball sitting out there, or yellow. It's orangish yellow, I guess, is the exact color. And they knew that the surface temperature was about 6,000 degrees. And when you look at the surface of the sun and it's continually burning, you would then be able to retrocalculate to determine that it wasn't a coal fire, it wasn't wood, it wasn't any form of chemical fire that we would be aware of. And they knew this in the Middle Ages. They knew that much about the sun, that there was something else going on there. They had no idea what it was. And of course, it turned out eventually the discovery of nuclear fusion, that the energy was contained in the nucleus of the atom. The chemical fires that we have, wood, coal, other sources of burning fires that we see on Earth, that you have oxygen, you might have propane or methane or other forms of petrol gas that burn with oxygen. Those are all chemical fires, and the chemical processes that give off the heat are due to the electrons in orbit around the nucleus. And that's a much lower energy level than the nuclear reactions that occur in the nucleus of the atom. And of course, the nucleus of the atom was discovered around the turn of the century in the 18s to the 1900s. That was about the era when they discovered the nucleus, and they then discovered X-rays. They started narrowing in, and eventually it was the discovery of E equals MC squared, the transfer of mass to energy, and it actually could be measured, that determined that there was a nuclear source of energy, and that's what the source of energy on the sun would be. So that all made sense, and now scientists could make a calculation of how much nuclear matter had to burn per second, per hour, or per year to maintain the temperature of the sun. Now, at the time, they thought that the sun was very constant. It looked the same every day, and so the assumption immediately was that the sun was constant over billions of years, millions and billions of years, that the sun would remain the same, and then eventually it would burn out and go through these other stellar cycles. And of course, a lot of research has been done on that particular topic, what happens to stars when they burn out. But we are in the middle era of our own star, the sun. And so scientists believed that the sun was very constant. And it was then once that was understood, that was the Einstein equals MC squared that pops out of relativity. Then there was a guy named Hans Bethe, and he won a Nobel Prize. He was at Cornell. I talked to him when I was there, and he was instrumental in getting me directed to some of the European journals where my papers began to be published, much to the chagrin of standard United States scientists. But at any rate, Hans Bethe's contribution, was the chemical chain, so to speak. They called it a chemical chain, but really it was the nuclear reaction chain that built up the larger atoms from the smaller atoms. In other words, the sequence of nuclear reactions that occurred in the sun to keep it fueled generation, nuclear generation after nuclear generation. In other words, once the hydrogen formed deuterium and helium, what happened to those? How did they then regenerate to create larger atomic species, atomic nuclei, etc.? So that was a big contribution. And then the concerted effort was on putting that nuclear energy down at the core of the sun, because you had a little problem. How could the sun kick off this energy? That was the big mystery. So the theoretical work concentrated on pressure. In other words, they imagined this star collapsing the hydrogen, and the only place you had enough pressure to create the nuclear reaction was down at the very core. So they imagined a central core of the sun being heated up, and that would be enough pressure to kick off the nuclear reaction. One of the methods for creating a nuclear bomb was the theoretical work went into practical application in creating a nuclear bomb. And the way they did this is they took a very stout, very sturdy metal enclosure. They put the uranium or the other materials to be the nuclear materials inside. And this is where plastic explosives came from in World War II. You couldn't get enough oxygen and dynamite inside one of these capsules to implode the nuclear charge, the nuclear material. So they invented plastics that were very highly explosive but did not need any oxygen. And so that's where the C4 and the other plastic explosives came from. It was actually from the nuclear program. And so at any rate, scientists were able to duplicate nuclear explosions, creating nuclear bombs, by creating pressure. So this solidified the idea that you needed a tremendous amount of pressure to kick off the nuclear explosions that would be maintained. And the only way they could think that this could happen is in the core of the sun. And that model is still in existence today. Standard science believes that the sun has a fusion core in the center of the sun, and that's the source of the heat of the sun. So all the calculations were done, everything seemed to be in order, and that would give you a very smooth orange-yellow glowing ball, and they figured out how much hydrogen had to be burning per hour, per second. And there's another little thing that happened in there. And, of course, being a physicist, going through a physics education, I was able to do all of these calculations myself as problems in physics books. This is part of your education, is understanding the physics of nuclear reactions, etc. And one of the side problems that you had to do was called the random walk. And in statistics, let me give you an example of a random walk. Let's just say you just go out on the street and you take a step to the right, and then you take a step to the left. And the idea is that let's flip a coin, and if it turns up heads, you take a step to the right. If it turns up tails, you take a step to the left. So let's flip our imaginary coin. Okay, it comes up heads, you take a step to the right. Flip it again. Oh, it turns up heads again, take another step to the right. Flip it again. Oh, now it's tails. Now you take a step to the left, but you're still one step to the right of where you started, the zero point. And now flip it again. It turns out tails again. Okay, now you're back to the right to where you started. Flip it again. Oops, heads. Take a step to the right. And the idea is, this is called a random walk. It's based on a random event, like flipping a coin. And you're going to step to the right or left based on this procedure. And what happens is the more times you flip your coin, the higher the probability that you will end up at the zero point, your starting point. And if you flip it enough times, you will actually get out quite far from the zero point, but then you will actually get back to the zero point and probably end up to the left of the zero point and to the right of the zero point. But the more times you flip the coin, if you mark your position on a chart, then the more times you flip the coin, the higher the probability that you will actually end up back at your zero point. And that's called a random walk, and it's a statistical process. There's a tremendous amount of mathematics and physics involved in this, but basically that's the random walk problem. Now let's do this in three dimensions. Imagine you're standing there at your spot, and you have three coins. Okay, you flip all three of them, and one of the coins is for you to walk ahead or backwards. One of the coins is for you to step sideways to the right or left, and the other coin is to make you go up or down one step. And this is in three dimensions now, remember. So now you flip your three coins and you move. You flip your three coins and you move. The idea is that, the idea is that you will then end up eventually back at your 000 point, the very original point of your where you started. And let's do this for an X-ray that comes out of a nuclear reaction in the core of the sun. It has a lot of pressure built up behind it, so the propensity for this X-ray is to start moving outwards away from the sun. And the other part of this problem is that X-ray is generated, it's absorbed. It's generated, it's absorbed. Each time it's generated, it takes on another energy. Excuse me. So let's look at the life of an X-ray. Excuse me, I'm getting a frog in my throat here. So let's take a look at an X-ray that's leaving an atom down at the core of the sun. It moves and is reabsorbed. It moves in another direction, is reabsorbed. It moves in another direction, is reabsorbed. And eventually, if you do this problem, it takes about 1 million years for that X-ray to work its way up to the surface of the sun, where it is then released as visible light or another X-ray. But the point is that when that X-ray or that energy finally gets up to the surface of the sun, the surface should be an absolutely smooth, uniform orange ball. And that's what they expected until they got some satellites up there that could actually look at the surface of the sun. That's when they saw all sorts of ununiform or non-uniform activity on the surface of the sun. They saw flaring. They discovered the solar corona, electrons circling the sun at millions of degrees. These are relativistic electrons. And that didn't make any sense. How do these electrons orbit the sun and just stay there? They should go flying off into space, because there's certainly not enough gravity in the sun to hold relativistic electrons. You see the solar wind coming off the surface, and you see solar bursts. You see small little point sources that are just shooting particles out into space to where you can actually see them, and that's the solar wind. All of this activity going on, and the nuclear core model of the sun does not explain any of it. So most of the theoretical work today dealing with the sun has to do with, gee, where's all this surface phenomenon coming from? You have waves, literally ocean waves, looking, they look like ocean waves rolling around the sun. You have particles coming out along magnetic field lines, and the general theoretical approach to date is that there are magnetic forces that form that somehow do all of this. The point is that the whole core fusion model of the sun is wrong. It's incorrect, and the source of fusion is up at the surface. And the thing that they were missing back around World War II, when all of this theoretical development occurred, the thing they were missing was the electrical component of the sun. It turns out that there are vast electrical storms up in the atmosphere of the sun, and this is where the fusion actually occurs. The Russians, working with me back in the mid-90s, were able to literally measure the surface core of the sun, showing that it was much cooler than the atmosphere. And I described that in my weather book. It's a experiment that the Russians performed, very simple and very convincing, that there is no fusion core at the center of the sun. But the point is, now the sun is expelling all of this energy that's coming from its surface, from the surface fusion. That's why the sun seems to be so unruly. But there's one small caveat or catch to all of this. The catch is that the sun is variable. It can vary by considerable amounts on a very short period of time. So this idea that the sun is stable over millions and billions of years is incorrect. In fact, it can change on a daily basis. So the past couple thousand years, the Earth has been somewhat in a very blessed position to have just the right amount of light to give us a beautiful water planet. But this may not last forever. Things can change, and the ancients tell us that things have changed. That solar wind comes to us, if there is, say, an object that comes into the solar system, a big object, it can discharge that solar capacitor. So instead of just having the August return current sheet coming back to the sun, we have tremendous amounts of energy being discharged from the far reaches of the solar system down to the sun, which can kick off the sun solar fusion reaction. And in fact, we could have a big mess on Earth overnight. There's all kinds of effects. Of course, my books talk about this and what could happen, what the scenarios are. But I wanted to give a description today because, as I said, the news media, the popular news media, has been coming out in past weeks talking about all of the efforts by standard science to explain these solar surface features. And they never really connect it to Earth weather, Earth volcanoes, earthquakes. And that's what we've been seeing, especially in that August time frame. At any rate, I'm once again out of time. I'll just quickly give the address again for the Berkeys. JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. That's $315, $315 check or money order. And if you don't have your own source of fresh water today, as I always say, you are crazy. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week. Good night.